Welcome to a new edition of the Neon Jazz Interview Series with jazz freelance saxophonist, leader, composer, arranger, and educator, the great Dave Schumacher. We got into his new 2026 album with Cubi called Agua con Gas, and an amazing ride in the world of music. He has been a fixture on the New York jazz scene for over 40 years. As a freelance baritone saxophonist, he has performed in more than 465 cities across 41 countries on 5 continents. From 1983 to 87, and again in 88 and 89, Dave toured the Americas and Europe as a member of Lionel Hampton's orchestra. A career highlight came in 1987 when he traveled to Japan with the Art Blakey Big Band to perform at the Mount Fuji Jazz Festival. And then in 1990, Dave became the original member of the Harry Connick Jr. Orchestra. We get into this whole wonderful story. Enjoy this interview.
I'm looking forward to getting into the album, to getting into your world. So thank you for taking a minute out today. I appreciate it.
Sure, no problem.
So let's begin our journey before we get into the new album and we get into your history of music by asking you this. 6 years ago, this pandemic was changing so much about our lives, the way we create, especially musicians. How did you get through that era, and how has it changed the way that you approach things today?
How did I get through it? Well, I didn't do much performing, that's for sure.
Right.
But I've been involved in a lot of teaching for the last 15 years, and I continue to teach as much as possible on Zoom for a while, which is not very ideal, but we try to keep the kids engaged, you know, and pass it on.
Yeah,
and I was also working with a musical instrument company I do some work for, RS Berkeley. So I have some different irons in the fire to keep things going, because, you know, I've tried to just be mainly a jazz musician, and you need other irons in the fire. Most of us do.
Yeah.
You know, the percentage of jazz musicians that actually full-time just do that is probably not that big. So there's many things. People into commercial music, you know, playing jobbing, you know, club dates, as they say, or jobbing dates in the Chicago where I came from. So I shied away from that. I'm more into teaching and working with this instrument company. So, you know, you do what you got to do.
Yep, make ends meet. I get it.
I spent many years touring, just living on music, playing. Yeah. So, yeah. You know, but getting older, things changed. Touring's changed. The pandemic changed, led you know, everything.
Well, I think that the beauty of the teaching world is that when I look at the jazz community, you know, it can be hard to make a living. It's obviously a difficult thing to just make money off of music, but to be able to educate the future, have a steady paycheck, get some benefits, get a retirement, it seems like it's pretty good if you can still keep playing and recording and all of that. It seems like a good melding of things.
Yeah, I mean, I really didn't start getting deep into the teaching when I was into my early 50s already, you know.
Yeah.
So I didn't do it for years and years, but it's been good since then. Plus, I had great mentors growing up and teachers that inspired me, and, you know, I'd like to pass it on too, because as much as possible. And, you know, youth today have, well, it seems like they're up against a lot more than we were.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
In many ways, you know, with the handheld devices and the lack of attention spans. A lot of different challenges. Everyone has challenges of every generation, but they're definitely a different set now.
Yeah, it's a different world for sure.
Mm-hmm.
So the new album is wonderful. I've played it on the show. I love the sound of it. Let's get into it. What was your vision for this project?
Of my working band, such that it is. We work as much as we can, and it's called Cubi. And it's a culmination of music I've been into for a very long time, really meeting the crossroads of straight-ahead jazz and Afro-Cuban or Latin jazz. Most of my career, I made my living just playing big bands and straight-ahead jazz, and always had interest in Latin jazz since 40 years, you know, many, many, many years. And on earlier recordings, I'd always do some Latin jazz-oriented and have, you know, the percussionist and be attentive to the correct stylistic things. But, and the influences that run deep from Machito, Eddie Palmieres, a huge long list. But I think the main influence of the direction of this band would be the Fort Apache Band, because it flows evenly between, you know, the Afro-Cuban and the jazz. So I like to say swings on both sides, because that's something a lot of jazz musicians aren't so aware of. Latin musicians, they talk about the swing, talking about when I played in salsa bands. I said, that's the swing tonight, you know. It's the groove. But in jazz, the swing might be something more specific in is related to jazz, you know, some very specific characteristics. So there's, you know, a specific small swing, and then there's bigger swing issues. But, you know, the idea is the band to be able to flow between the two sides equally, authoritatively, and correctly, if there is such a thing as correct. But paying attention to clave and also swing, you know, because a lot of times jazz musicians are not aware of the, you know, the real roots of the Afro-Cuban music, and they'd say, let's play a Latin tune, and it's not really observing the heart of that music.
So talk to me a little bit about what you're hoping the listener gets from this album.
Oh, I just, mainly, I want them to feel the groove and enjoy the swing. And there's intellectual side to it, our compositions and the arrangements of some of the other guys in the band. So there's the intellectual side. But the main line, you know, is, you know, to enjoy the groove of the music and have the music touch you, really, you know. We can analyze, I think sometimes we analyze music too much, you know, either it's swinging or it's not, you know?
Yeah. So are your roots in Chicago, you said?
I grew up, was born and raised in the Chicago area, in Chicago, and then in the suburbs as I grew older.
Okay. So take me back to your roots. Why did you pick up the saxophone? Why did music? Why did jazz? Why all of this? How did this happen?
All right. So let me try to do the short story. We lived in the city of Chicago all through the 60s when I was a little kid, and there wasn't much music program there. And then towards the early 70s, we moved into the suburbs, and there was a music program. And I remember my parents had jazz records when I was little. I used to always play them when I was, you know, between 5 and 9, 10 years older. And funny thing is, there was a Jerry Mulligan record and a Lars Gulin record, which were both baritone sax players. Also, Louis Armstrong, Ramsey Lewis, I think Jonah Jones. They had 5 or 6 jazz records that I just kept playing when I was a little kid. So I was drawn to that music somehow. And when we moved to where there was a better music program, I had the opportunity to start playing. And honestly, I started playing sax because one of the other kids in the class I really disliked, and he played sax. It's not the greatest motive. It kind of makes me laugh now. But you know, I mean, other than the fact that I loved music, that was my motivation for the specific instrument. Kind of strange. Yeah.
So what was the first live jazz show or live show that you saw that made you think, I want to be up there one day, or just made a big impact on you?
Well, I mean, the high school in the area had a great big band. So when you're a little middle school kid, that's very impactful. Yeah. But, and, you know, jazz was important to that school area. But as I got into high school, I started going to the clubs in Chicago. In fact, mainly this club called the Jazz Showcase, which still exists. And this is in the 70s, mid-70s in Chicago, and we used to go every week. And, you know, it was drinking age was 21, but the owner, Joe Siegel, actually, his name, he was a promoter in Chicago for decades and decades, brought a lot of great music there. He let us kids in for the first set. And we'd sit in the front row drinking our Coca-Cola and sitting, you know, just a couple of feet from Sonny Stitt, Dexter Gordon, Yusef Lateef, Teddy Edwards, Milt Jackson, just all the cats that were still around playing in the 70s, which was quite a few still. Yeah. So that Art Blakey's band, Max Roach, Finney's Newborn, Don Patterson, just goes on and on. It's a massive list. We went every week for several years. And that was the most impactful thing to push me further in that direction, I think. Wow. Not that I ever thought I could do that, but I was deeply drawn to it. Yeah.
That's an amazing education. So the baritone is an instrument. Every time I hear it, and especially when I see it, it's a really deep anchor for any band. It has such a there's such a resonance to it. There's depth. But as someone that's played this instrument for as long as you have, what is it that you've discovered about the horn that has made you more endeared to playing the baritone?
I mean, I started on alto sax, and I still play all saxophones and some flute and clarinet. If you're a woodwind player, you have to have some flexibility doubling. But the baritone is my voice and has been for many, many years, over 40-something years. But I did start playing baritone sax in about 7th grade. And at that point, it's because they needed someone to play it. It wasn't that I was drawn to it so much at that point, but my love for the sound of it grew over time. And to me, it's just another saxophone. And I think when people see it, they see this massive saxophone and it's really low pitch. But it's just another way to express yourself. And I feel it's the best way to, for me to extend my voice. I mean, it's become my voice.
You know, the thing about listening to your album right now in 2026 America, what I think in the back of my mind when I hear this mosaic of different cultures and different flavors that make America what it is, especially during this stressful time of immigration issues and war and all of that in America, how much are you thinking about the music you're making now to give people that level of swing and escape and just absorbing into the music and putting the headlines aside? Is that something you're thinking about anymore now?
You mean as far as bringing people together?
Yeah, bringing people together, giving them music, giving them a way of just kind of absorbing into the music and getting away from the stress that we're living in this country at this particular moment.
Well, I don't necessarily think of it, but I mean, in a way, I mean, we have jazz is a high art form. But it also is entertainment. It always has been. I mean, I spent my early years playing with Lionel Hampton when I was in my 20s for quite a few years. And I learned that from being in his band. You know, he was, in the history of the music, he was one of the greats of his instrument, you know, on a level with Coleman Hawkins on the saxophone from the same era. He was kind of like that to the vibes. An incredible musician. And gave many musicians opportunities. Going through his bands, everyone played in his band for very short or longer time, but he was coming out of the entertainment mold. I don't see myself as an entertainer like that, but in the bottom line, we are there entertaining people. People who can be entertained by art, they can be entertained by more overt entertainment, like, you know, like pop music. You know, it's focused on scientifically entertaining people, I guess. But we hope people are entertained and feel the groove of the music, and our, you know, helps them pass the time in a positive way. It also enriches them and makes them think. One thing about jazz is it's music that makes you think.
Yeah. So when you finally crossed that threshold and decided that you were going to become a professional musician, and you had this idea of what it would be like to be a musician, and now you've lived this life for a long time, what's been the difference between the dream you had of what it would be like to live your life as a musician and actually living in this world for as long as you have?
It's an interesting question, because I kind of never thought I was going to be a musician growing up. I had a deep love for music, and since I was 10 years old, played. But I was also very good at math and science, and when actually I went to university, I was studying biomedical engineering for the first year, until I decided, I got to get some, you know, closer to New York, because I used to watch the listings of Village Voice and New Yorker and see who was playing in the clubs. And I would, you know, from my high school years, checking out the Jazz Showcase in Chicago, I saw all the people playing in New York. I said, man, I'm going to go there. There's a lot more people playing there every night than I get to see in Chicago. So I wanted to get closer to there. And but I didn't have a clear vision that I was going to be a professional musician. I just kept going and studying and playing. And I was very fortunate when I moved to the East Coast to end up at Rutgers University and having great mentors there. I mean, Paul Jeffrey, great saxophone player, was Thelonious Monk's last saxophone player and played with many people. And also Kenny Barron was teaching there, Larry Ridley, Freddie Waits, Michael Carvin, great faculty, and it was... it was a different time. Jazz education was different then. It was just about hanging out and playing and absorbing influence and knowledge from these mentors, and hanging out in New York as much as possible too, and start going to sit in the jam sessions. And it wasn't like I one day said, I'm going to be a professional musician. It wasn't like that. It just kind of happened because of my love. Yeah, I mean, it wasn't. And I was fortunate. Paul Jeffrey hooked me up with Lionel Hampton when I was 23. I spent much of the 80s with him. Although I got to play with other people, I got to go to Japan with Art Blakey Big Band for Mount Fuji Fest in 87. Then from 90 to 2019, I predominantly played with Harry Connick Jr. And so that was a very long gig, almost 19 years, which provided a stable income for me and a lot of free time to do other freelance work too. So really more than anything, I feel super fortunate the way it happened for me, you know. After, really was in a financial crisis, Harry downsized his band, and I haven't played with him since 2009, and a lot of things happened in life that coincided with divorce, a lot of changes in my life happened, but then I kind of morphed into the scene of doing more teaching, working with an instrument company, and trying to play more of my own music, which is where I've been on this track for the last 14, 15 years. But it wasn't until 2021 when I really got the idea to put Kuba together. And it's been my fundamental focus for musical development and creativity since.
So you've been fortunate to have a front seat to a lot of legends and luminaries over your career, from Lionel to Harry to the Art Blakey Big Band, and even the early shows. What have you taken from all of those experiences that you want this younger, next generation of jazz cats to understand? What do you want them to get from all of this experience that you've lived and witnessed throughout your life?
Well, like I said, I was super fortunate to be going through those scenes. The young musicians now don't have those same opportunities to be that close to people that were closer to the actual creation, people that were from the swing era and bebop era and so on. I mean, we're the older guys now. So I'm 66 now.
Yeah.
Oldish, I say. When I get up in the morning, I look in the mirror and say, who's that old so-and-so? But in my brain, I'm still about 13 or 14, I think.
I get it.
So I can relate to the kids too. They look at me that you look like my grandpa, but you sure don't act like him. So, but you know, hopefully I instill what I want them to find is their love for the music. You know, that's what drove me, the love for the music. And I find it's hard to even get kids to focus to listen to a whole song. I mean, I was a super vinyl hound when I was growing up in the 70s, so I spent every dime I had buying albums, you know. When you used to be able to get Blue Note cutouts for a dollar or two, and I spent a lot more too, you know. But but I searched out. I was a collector. I mean, I felt like more like a collector than a musician, but I think, you know, you need to be a student of what came before you, you know, of course. But back to what I was saying is the attention span of these kids is so short, in general, most of them. You know, there's a few that the light bulb comes on and they kind of get it. And I can share more with them and talk to them about things from the past, my personal story, who I played with, things that I learned from them. But it's rare because most of the time, most of the young people I'm working with, attention span is so short. And that's kind of the biggest problem I've come across. Yeah. So when I do have one, which I have several of these students that where I say the light bulbs come on at various levels, but the light bulbs on, I really try to invest in them because they're really into it and they want to draw information from me and they're a little more patient about checking things out, you know.
Yeah. So what do you like the best about being a professional musician, being an educator, being in this jazz community? What gets you up every day? What motivates you?
What gets me up every day? Man, paying the bills.
Right. Good coffee.
We have to do that, unfortunately. Trying to pay the bills and not do things I don't want to do. That would be... But, you know, especially with this Kuwai project, I get up and work on music often or much more. I mean, I had my own groups over all the years. I was mainly a side man, and I would do gigs in between because there's always off time. But I never had a focused concept for a group like this. So we just finished, this album was just released a month ago, but I've already got almost half of the next album written. So, you know, we're getting ready to play some gigs. I want to play the new music already, but we really need to promote the new album, you know. So it's, but that forward motion keeps me going, you know. That's one reason to get up. And trying to help these younger people too, because this, you know, I don't want to get deep with all with the scene of the world, but we're up against a lot right now. Let's leave it at that.
Yeah, we certainly are. So let me ask you this. At the end of the day, everyone has a perception of you. Family, friends, fans, students, everyone on the bandstand, but you're the one that runs the show, the proverbial show. What's your perception of you? Who do you think you are?
Can you repeat that? You were breaking up. I couldn't understand what you said.
So everyone has an idea of who they think you are. You play a different role in everybody's lives. From the musicians on the bandstand, the students in the seats, everyone that gets your music, family, friends, but you're the one that runs your perception. Who do you think you are? What's your perception of you?
You know what? I try to be the same around everyone. You know, at this point, that's the one thing. I want to try to be just one person and be transparent and true to who I am. Because in the past, I tried to be a lot of different people and lived many lives and went through a lot of things, positive and negative. You know, I try to live positively and just be who I am for anyone. I mean, I have to watch, I have to watch my language around kids, but other than that, I still act the same I would with them as I would with my friends. I'm not gonna put on a business front or this or that, you know, which sometimes you have to do those things, but I just don't wanna have to be full of it, you know. I just wanna be true to myself, you know, and I'm good with that, you know. I feel fortunate to have a career mostly as a side man, doing my own music too, and being in the mix. You know, the great musicians that are around are at such a high level, and I still, you know, work towards getting to a higher level with my music, you know. But I'm just
So,
trying to become the best me I am, you know. I'm not
yeah,
trying to be anyone else, you know.
for sure. So I gotta know, especially with Harry Connick, you had to have played electric, huge venues. What was one of the most memorable crowds of electricity and volume that you played for during that time with him?
Yeah, I mean it's pretty amazing, so, you know, but it almost at some point came to feel like checking into the office for work that day. Tap's like, whoa, check this out. That's a lot of people out there, you know, and it's amazing all those people checking out the music and really getting into it. And but that's the danger. You don't want to let it to become like you're checking into the office. You know, like older musicians would say, every time you play, you got to play like it might be the last time, because it might be the last time you ever play. So you don't want to just go and check into the office and fill the bill, you know, and come up to the level of what's necessary. You want to try to exceed that level and always propel yourself to go higher.
So if anybody wants to catch you live, pick up the new album, any of the other good business, where can they go?
I'm sorry, but the Zoom stream keeps
Oh, it's
pixelating
getting
your voice.
crackly.
It's
Where can
cracking, yeah.
you where can people catch you live or pick up a copy of the new album?
Oh, okay, yeah. That's very important.
Yes.
Thank you very much. Okay, it's not the physical copies aren't being distributed, but they are distributed on my Bandcamp page.
Okay.
So if you go to Bandcamp and search Dave Schumacher, Agua Con Gas. Or Cubi, Cubeye, but another way to get there would be my website. It's cubiemusic.com. That would be Cubeyemusic.com. Mouse. I mean, when I said Mouse, I'm thinking Mickey Mouse.
That's, I know. I was, when you did that. Well, I will put all of those links in the show notes. I'll make it
Yeah,
easy.
don't put Mouse on the end. It's
No,
not
I
the good
won't. I'm going
thing.
to stay away from Walt Disney. No, we're good. David, this has been wonderful. Thank you, sir. Thank you for what a wealth of knowledge you have and wisdom. Thank you so much.
All right, thank you very much. Really appreciate you contacting me for the interview. It's been
Yeah.
great.
Thanks for listening and tuning in to another Neon Jazz interview, where we give you a bit of insight into the finest players and minds in New York City, Kansas City, and spots all over the world, giving fans all that jazz. And thanks to Dave for swinging on by the show. If you want to hear more Neon Jazz interviews, you can find us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Subscribe to us at YouTube. And for everything Neon Jazz, go to the neonjazz.blogspot.com. Until next time, enjoy the jazz, my friends.
Neon Jazz.